Hello and welcome back to the podcast. This is episode number 10, and today we're going to be looking at something. I guess I've had this question for a while now. What's more important, brains or beauty? I'm going to dig straight into it because this is going to be a long research paper for us to look at, and there's going to be plenty more to talk about. So I'm going to introduce the paper. It's called Brains or Beauty: Causal Evidence on the Returns to Education and Attractiveness in the Online Dating Market, 2021. Only the most recent research papers for this particular podcast. And it's by Johan Egebark, I believe I pronounced that correctly, and colleagues. So let's begin. Few choices in life are as important and complex as the choice of a partner. This choice involves, among other things, the partner's preferences of oneself and others, which are difficult to observe. Our purpose here is to measure the underlying partner preferences that shape partner matches, where in particular we study how heterosexual men and women value brains as measured by educational attainment levels versus beauty as measured by facial attractiveness ratings in a partner. There are two good reasons to focus on partner preferences, where the first is social scientists of all disciplines have developed various theories linking partner traits to partner matching through different partner preferences. These traits on their own are highly correlated between partners, much more so than for other traits, and together often thought of as substitutes, with more educated men partnering with less educated but more attractive women as a popular example. These matching patterns, however, can be the result of any of the three most prominent families of partner preferences. In other words, the homophilic preference, the universal preference, and the traditional preference. Now, as your research literature tourist guide, it's my job to explain what the three preferences are, the homophilic and the universal and the traditional, where the homophilic preference is where individuals value partners with similar traits to oneself. The universal preference suggests that certain things, certain characteristics like big brains and bigger beauty are indicators of good genetic health, and so they're a universal trait that we all desire. Universal as in people from sub-Saharan Africa to northern Scandinavia are all going to more or less prefer the same features or the same traits that they look for in their partners. And lastly, there's the traditional preference, which is a more contemporary and recent idea by economists and sociologists, which uses gender norms to identify and explain marital asymmetries in brains versus beauty. The easiest way to explain this asymmetry is men are typically expected to be the breadwinners, and again, we're talking in terms of gender norms with the traditional preference mindset. So if the men are meant to be breadwinners, then obviously a female partner would look for a man who's quite smart, because smarter men are oftentimes more resourceful, and thus they can do their job in their traditional gender role much better. So now that I've explained the three frameworks for which people tend to choose their partners, let's continue on and look at some of the limitations that actually influence the demographics or the sample sizes that they use in these types of studies. I believe I've spoken about all of these limitations throughout the podcast, especially in the episode for the fear of being alone, but one of the biggest ones is selection bias, where people generally tend to meet people, their partners, with similar traits to themselves because they are self-regulating the environment that they tend to spend their time in. A great example of this is if I like rock climbing, I'm going to be going to rock climbing gyms, and I'm going to meet a partner who also likes rock climbing, and I rock climb because I like staying fit. So my partner, it's safe to assume that I would like my partner to be fit as well. And so in the end, whether I like it or not, I'm going to meet somebody who's very similar to me. This goes against the idea of positive assortative mating, because we're not really assorting anyone by anything. There's no randomness, especially when all the people at that rock climbing gym example more or less look the same. Researchers often like to randomly assort people, so rock climbing guy pairs with figure skating girl, and then we observe if that match happens because of looks or beauty or some other thing, because these two groups, rock climbing and figure skating people, would have similar things, but they wouldn't be exactly the same in terms of their traits. This concept is known as search friction, and the main takeaway should be that we actively search out and surround ourselves with people that are like us, so when a researcher is trying to conduct some kind of study, they need to have the opposite, somebody who isn't like us, to actually gain some insight into how we make our decisions. Another limitation that you need to be aware of is that partner choices are based on a combination of rationality and emotions. Here they say that if a fear of rejection leads to disappointment, then risk-averse individuals are going to act strategically to minimize rejection, and as such, they're going to set their standards a lot lower. They may go out on more dates. We covered this idea of the fear of being single in a previous podcast episode, so it's basically the same concept. Depending on how comfortable you are with being single, your mate preferences and your dating preferences, your selection criteria is going to vary greatly. An example of this might be that some people may compensate and go for brains, even though they physically really want somebody who's good looking. So they go for brains, but they desire beauty. And this is because it's easier to find brainy people than it is to find beautiful people in where they are, their environment. And so they're compensating, but this is because they have personally a higher fear of being single, or they're more risk averse, and so they're not being true to themselves on what they really want. And the researchers can't read your minds, they can't pick up on this, and data that comes out of it is ultimately going to be flawed and not be a true representation of what reality would be like for these dating preferences. This fear of being single is so prevalent that the researchers know that even without search frictions, so say they find two completely different people who have the right amount of traits that the researchers are looking for, because one of the participants have some kind of anxiety or fear that the other person is not going to accept them, they may completely change what they really feel like on the inside and say something that's more socially acceptable, therefore giving us flawed data. One way to overcome these issues, and this is really the best we can do, is to randomly assign traits, so facial attractiveness and education levels, to made up people, so fictitious stimuli, and say this man has 10 degrees and this man is a male model, and then evaluate what the participants actually choose. So this is the causal evidence part, or empirical evidence as I like to consider it, rather than asking them, would you choose somebody with brains or would you choose somebody with beauty? Because if you've seen any of the street interviews on YouTube, there's plenty where people go around asking, usually women, what they look for in a partner. There's a huge variety of answers and nobody can really give a very good reason for why they chose one or the other. Whereas when you look at the research data, the consensus is more or less the same, that a lot of women just choose genetically healthy partners. And what we're trying to answer in this episode is beauty, or are brains the more desirable characteristic? Previous literature on the topic, such as Kurzban and Whedon 2005, found that most speed daters were more likely to propose to more attractive partners rather than more brainy partners or intelligent ones, and these were our exact conclusions from a very recent podcast episode on speed dating preferences, where the most important thing for getting matches in a speed dating scenario is, unsurprisingly, your physical attractiveness, and this goes above everything else, such as your intelligence, your personality, your nurturing and fatherlyhood or motherlyhood characteristics, so on and so forth. From Fisman et al. 2006, they found with Columbia University students, women tended to choose intelligence over attractiveness, and men tended to choose attractiveness over intelligence, which is not unsurprising when you consider the example I gave with the traditional framework for why we choose partners. The traditional framework, if you don't remember, is under stereotypical gender normative roles, such as men being the breadwinners and women doing domestic work at home, men and women respectively tend to choose partners that maximize their ability to undertake their gender normative roles. So if men are breadwinners, women choose smarter men because they're more resourceful and they can make a greater income. Bello and Francesconi 2013 found that both men and women valued attractiveness over brains, and this difference in results that we're seeing from all of the speed dating studies is a part of the search friction issue that I mentioned earlier, where it's very hard to control for other confounding effects and traits that may influence the desirability of intelligence versus physical attractiveness. What their paper found was that it's less dependent on your education level or your intelligence, and more so on the prestigiousness or the value of the work that you do. So men tended to date down in terms of prestigiousness, and they tended to choose partners who were in less prestigious occupations, whereas women tended to choose partners in more prestigious occupations regardless of their educational achievements. But the answer isn't as clear-cut as I'm making it out to seem. From Hitch et al. 2010 and Skorpek et al. 2011, both cited in this particular paper that we're looking at, they found that men and women both tend to send the same amount of messages to very attractive profiles in an online dating scenario, suggesting that male and female online daters shy away from profiles that are less attractive than themselves, but only male daters dare to initiate contact with profiles that are physically more attractive than themselves, which should intuitively make sense because men are the ones who have to often initiate the courtship process. And women have an abundance of suitors, so they don't really need to take the risk of rejection by trying to shoot their shot with a more attractive man. The main takeaway to pay attention to, however, is that both men and women tend to avoid contact with profiles who have lower education levels than themselves. So this suggests that it's not just a question of beauty over brains or one over the other being more important. They may just be equally important as hard requirements or thresholds that a man or woman must meet to actually be even considered for the position of a long-term partner. Now, we've talked about the idea of hard and soft thresholds that people have when going into a dating market in the previous episode, or I believe it was the one before that. So hopefully you can see how all of our episodes build upon each other. And it's really important that you understand what I'm saying in the previous ones, so you can understand the limitations and biases that exist in this field of psychology. One more study I'd like to talk about is Ong and Wang's 2015, who used random assignment to give 360 artificial profiles in a Chinese dating website some number of income level and attractiveness, and they found men were indifferent to the income of the women, but the women strongly rated higher earning men as more attractive, even if they really weren't physically speaking. Why is this important? Well, if we understand that education has some kind of correlation to your ability to get some kind of higher income, then it should suggest that brains would be chosen over beauty for men especially, because this correlates to resourcefulness and income and all of the reasons I gave before. Understandably, maybe physical attractiveness will rank lower on the desirability scale. But what I did mention in a previous podcast is that a lot of women put down their preferences for what they desire in a partner, and the last few episodes have been all on dating preferences. But one of the big limitations we have with this type of study is that women experience a lot of social stigma, and so when they say that they desire physical attractiveness more, and we did find this to be the case in short-term dating scenarios, to quickly reiterate for you, women experience a higher cost in a short-term sexual encounter, and understandably they choose more attractive men for that short-term encounter because they satisfy some sort of physical desire or carnal desire, and really at the base of it, we all just desire more attractive partners. We always have and always will. It's just that resourcefulness and your income and, to a lesser degree, your brains and your intelligence are secondary characteristics that we also have to take into consideration now because it's a byproduct of the context that we live in. For instance, the world is getting increasingly more overpopulated, income inequality is increasing, so you want to really snag yourself a rich and wealthy man, because if you don't, you're just going to be left behind and the gap between the rich and the haves-nots is just going to keep increasing. Understandably, it could be that we keep placing a greater and greater importance on your intelligence and, more importantly, your resourcefulness or how wealthy you are, how much money you have, because the need for that is just so much greater than your physical attractiveness, to a point where it outweighs the desire for good and healthy genes, because staying alive, having a comfortable life, is now the most paramount concern in a dating scenario. Good example of this is when women in impoverished or developing countries choose out partners from foreign countries that are considerably wealthier than the local man in their country, but oftentimes less attractive physically speaking. And I'm sure you've heard the cliche of old rich man marries a young, attractive, impoverished woman from a developing country. And you really have to ask yourself, why would she go with that man when physically, there's not going to be a whole lot of sexual desire for somebody who's perhaps 30, 40 years older than you, and all their bits and parts don't really work the same anymore. There isn't going to be a whole lot of carnal desire there. But regardless, she's still happy with that arrangement. And that's because in their context, in that developing context, physical attractiveness plays a lesser role than actual resourcefulness, wealth, and to a lesser degree, your intelligence. Does this mean that she still doesn't desire for an attractive young man around her age and has all the physical fit characteristics that you'd want? No, of course not. She still desires it, but it's just not in the cards right now, or it's just not important. And ideally, we'd want a man who's both attractive and rich and intelligent, has everything, but sometimes there's trade-offs and you have to choose. And what you choose is dependent on context. And we've spoken about this many, many times, especially in the last two podcast episodes. On that train of thought, I'd like to point out that for a Western scenario, and it's probably safe to assume that most of these listeners that listen to this podcast are from a Western society, we place a much greater importance on the individual rather than the community or other people. You may have noticed this, especially now with the anti-vax crisis. Why is anti-vax even a thing? I don't want to get political or even talk about that, but that's all about the individual, the rights of the individual being more important than the rights of the greater community. Vaccines do work and they do protect the greater community, but some people, and being raised in an individualistic society, much like capitalist America is, then it's safe to assume that some people just feel that their rights are more important than others, and that's why they refuse to get the vaccine, because they feel that it could harm their health. And I understand that there's very valid concerns, but undeniably, they're putting their health above everybody else's health. Now, compare this to countries where the community is more important than the individual, like Norway or Japan. Even accounted for the population differences per capita, they have much more consistent vaccination rates, and this is because they understand the importance of community over their own individual health. And this is not a commentary on which is better, but this is a very real psychological phenomenon that's often covered in developmental psychology, so the psychology concerning how children are raised. And oftentimes, when you're raised in a more socialist country or a more utilitarian policy, it's understandable that you develop ideas of greater community over yourself. Versus when you're raised in a more individualistic country or a community, then the achievements of one person, like billionaires Jeff Bezos or Bill Gates, are applauded over the actual people that helped them get there. Why is this important? Why am I even bringing up the differences between individual versus the community? Well, it's actually very important in dating preferences, where those with a greater emphasis on community would choose intelligence. And that's because they understand that intelligence leads to resourcefulness, and resourcefulness leads to income, which leads to a greater quality of life for your offspring. Whereas those more on the individual scale would choose physical attractiveness, or be more inclined to choose physical attractiveness. And that's because, I say this all the time, at the end of the day, you're going to be the one that's in bed with your partner, not your family, not your children. It's going to be you, and so you want a partner that's physically attractive. Now, onto the experiment itself. They got 12 fictitious profiles, split them in half, so 6 female, 6 male, and then had a total of 88 males and 54 female faces, which they assigned to each of the 6 and 6 groups of fictitious profiles. And then this is the part that I didn't really quite get. They sent out invites for a serious relationship to random people, and then measured the responses that these profiles would get under the different independent variables like education level, physical attractiveness, and gender. When I say that they sent out invitations to random people for a serious relationship, it's basically like if you match with somebody on Tinder, you send a message, and your response rate is highly dependent on things like your physical attractiveness, your education, and your gender. So it's more or less the same gist. They're not using Tinder as the data set. They're using a simulated environment, which is similar to Tinder, but more for serious relationships. And the fictitious profiles are all from 1985 and older. So it's more for long-term serious relationships. And that's what we're looking at, not for short-term encounters. If you remember what I said, short-term encounters and long-term relationship characteristics, we look for different things when we're trying to decide for who goes where. The results, however, They're not surprising to me, but they may be surprising to you. Basically, for female profiles, so men rating women, unsurprisingly, attractive women got far more responses than unattractive ones, almost on a linear graph from high, medium to low attractiveness. But what was interesting is that men's profiles, so women rating men, attractiveness also had the same correlation of attractive equals more matches, but men received far fewer responses in general. So that makes sense, because men are meant to be leading the courtship process. That's the expectations that we have in the society. So when female profiles reach out to men, they may feel like it's either a scam or they may just feel off-put. That wasn't the interesting part, however. That was just a warm-up to what we're getting to now. In the question of brains versus beauty, I'll answer it right now for you. It's beauty. Beauty wins over brains. Why is that? Because with men's profiles, so women rating men, university and high school graduates had the same response rates, so it made quite literally no difference. Whereas for women's profiles, so men rating women, high school graduates had the slight edge over university graduates, meaning that there's a slight but significant preference for less educated women over more educated ones. The real kicker, however, the response rate, the advantage that you get from being more attractive than the average person is far greater in your online dating success than the advantages you get from having a university education over a high school diploma. Interestingly enough, this goes for both men and women, even though the context of this experiment is for serious long-term relationships. If you remember back to the three proposed frameworks, like the traditional framework, it would make sense that for long-term relationships, women would choose smarter men over more attractive men because it's just beneficial, but that's not necessarily the case. Looks still prevail over everything else, and I guess we've seen this time and time again in every episode at this point, especially in the speed dating episodes, and this is a causational study, mind you, which means we're looking at the actions of the participants, not necessarily what they say. If you've dealt with more than two people in your entire life, you know that we can say one thing and do another, so human beings can be notoriously unreliable sometimes. Another thing, if you go back to the title of this study, it's the returns to education and attractiveness. So in other words, we're not looking at which is greater, but we're looking at what the advantage is of going from average education to above average education, or average attractiveness to above average attractiveness. And it would seem that the benefits of being more beautiful is far greater than the benefits of being more brainy. Why is that? Well, if I had to take a guess before we actually go into what the researchers think, it's to do with indicators of genetic fitness. Nowadays, anyone and everyone can get into a university. Might not be the best, but you can get into a university if you pay enough. And in this way, university education becomes a commodity. It's no longer a measure of your drive or your ability, your intelligence, your passion. It's just something that if your parents have enough money, especially in America where, I don't know, well, how much is your college fee? It's like $100,000 for a degree, which is insane. Ivy League bribes happen all the time. There's endorsements. If your parents are legacies at that university, there's so many ways you can get in now. It's no longer really a measure of any type of book smart intelligence. And I mean intelligence in the most traditional one-dimensional way. This makes it a poor indicator of genetic fitness. If anyone can get in, if anyone has enough money, or if they can cheat their way in, then it's not really a very accurate indicator of how intelligent or capable your children may be. On the other hand, beauty, physical beauty, is very difficult to change. Plastic surgery can do amazing things, but it's more expensive than a college degree, and I can promise you it's a lot more painful and requires a lot more dedication. And many times the patient may just have unrealistic aesthetic goals, just look at Ollie London, and may not get what they want. For that reason, the way you look is a much more honest indicator of your genetic fitness because it cannot be changed as easily. Things like your testosterone ornamentation, so having a strong jaw, brow ridge, while you can get implants for them, most people choose not to. And an even better one is your physical height, which is very difficult to change. You can go through limb lengthening surgery, which is expensive. It's like $70,000 to $120,000 USD, and it's 6 months of downtime. So those are very honest indicators of your genetic fitness, and that's why physical beauty is often regarded over any other trait every single time, every single podcast episode, from the speed dating studies to the correlational studies to the causational studies to the quasi studies to the true experiments. Every single aesthetic paper we look at, beauty wins over every other trait. So I hate to break it to you, but sometimes you cannot compensate for true indicators of genetic fitness. Although nowadays modern medicine is truly amazing and there is a lot you can change about yourself if you do want to. Going back to the paper, what the researchers suggest is that their findings most strongly correlate with the universal preferences, where men prefer more attractive women over their education levels and women prefer more intelligent men over their attractiveness levels, although this extrapolation is weak and the findings of this study do throw a wrench into that. What the researchers draw from this is that partner preferences imply that most men and women end up in traditional relationships where husbands are better educated than their wives, possibly with traditional roles of household specialization. Second, the same partner preferences imply that not every man and woman will find a partner. The least preferred groups, unattractive, low-educated men and unattractive, high-educated women, are the last in line to choose a partner. Since they indicate not to like each other, they may be better off single. Now, these words will undeniably probably sting a few people in the audience, and while it's easy to blame the patriarchy for suggesting that in heteronormative couples, men are slightly more educated than their partners, it is the women who actually decide on whether that relationship will even exist or not. When the female counterpart is the childbearer in virtually all mammals, it makes sense that she's going to be very selective in who she chooses, and according to what's known as Befort's law, proposed by Robert Bruffault, an English surgeon and anthropologist, when the female can derive no benefit from a relationship with the male, then that relationship doesn't take place. I see people use this law, Bruffault's law. It's not actually a law, it's more of a theory, and it's never actually been proven in any research study. But then again, the theory of gravity is also just a theory, but I think we can mostly agree that it does exist. I read this section from a post by Dr. Dale Hartley talking about the law. We already know, of course, that women wield the ultimate veto power in the mating game. It is women who give the thumbs up or thumbs down to any advances or proposals by men. Bruffault embellishes this truism by asserting that intimate relationships between men and women result from a calculated cost-to-benefit analysis by women. Now, in the previous episodes, we have seen proof of this cost-to-benefit analysis, especially in short-term versus long-term sexual encounters, but it would make a lot of intuitive sense that for a long-term partnership, you would choose somebody with traits better than yourself in the hopes of giving your children a better chance. If every woman in every filial generation does this, then over time, that family's lineage would become taller, stronger, smarter, and more resourceful, and for that reason, the overall genetic desirability of that family would increase. That's why women choose partners that are slightly more educated than they are, in hopes of giving their children more resources and higher intelligence. So it's not some nefarious patriarchal standard that in a lot of typical relationships, the man is oftentimes slightly more educated than the woman. But let's look at the other end of the spectrum. In the research paper, they did mention that highly educated but unattractive women were seen as the least desirable group, similar to unattractive and uneducated men, which does seem quite contradictory because education is seen as something that really has no downsides. It's something that's utilitarian and benefits everyone. However, under Bruffault's law, if women are the decision makers of a relationship, then ideally they'd want men that are even more educated than themselves, and if they're highly educated, the pool of men that are even more educated than themselves is a very small subset. The alternative would be dating down in terms of education, so somebody, say, with a doctorate, dating down to somebody who only has a bachelor's or even a high school diploma. But when looking at this under the universal preferences framework, that men choose women based on their looks and women choose men based on their resource and ability, then there's really no reason for a woman to compromise in her selection on the one thing that's really crucial to her, and that is intelligence, or more correctly, a man's resource gathering ability, because from a biological perspective, that's really the main value that a man brings to a relationship. As women become more and more educated, they seek men smarter than themselves, and so are unwilling to compromise in this idea of a hard threshold, which we spoke about, I believe, 2 episodes ago, because women bear a much more significant cost in a relationship of eventually being a child bearer. So if a man isn't valued very highly by society, and the way in most Anglospheric countries we value a man's worth is through his resources, then there's absolutely no reason for a woman to value that man highly in any other way. What else does he bring to the table? Humor? Personality? Companionship? That's great and all, but it doesn't pay the bills at the end of the day. And so for that reason, even though it's to the detriment of many highly educated women around the world, they're unwilling to sacrifice on a potential partner's education level, because under the universal mate preference framework, it's really the man's main value proposition here. Now, as for why more educated women are seen as less desirable, it could be that the men rating these women may feel personally attacked or a sense of rejection, and so as a self-soothing or compensatory measure, they rate more educated women lower because they don't expect those women to, in turn, respond well to their advances if they're of a lower education level than that woman. If you remember, towards the beginning of the podcast, we mentioned that women have a certain threshold, and again, the idea of a hard versus a soft threshold, women have a hard threshold where if a man doesn't meet a certain education level, he's disqualified altogether as a potential long-term partner. Highly educated women with, say, PhDs and doctorals, it's very hard to one-up that, and many women are looking for men who are slightly higher in education level than they are. So as a man, if you only have a bachelor's or a master's, you're going to feel personally attacked and maybe even a bit threatened, and for fear of rejection, you may rate her to be less desirable. So realistically, it takes two to tango, and both parties are to blame for why this dynamic exists. To leave you with some key takeaways and to summarize everything we've talked about, let's go back for a bit. Some of the findings are that the effect of attractiveness on the likelihood to respond is significantly positive and quantitatively large, identical for both men and women. And the second result is that the effect of education on the likelihood to respond is significantly negative for men, but effectively zero for women. If you don't understand what that means, I'm going to try to put it into simpler terms. The benefit you get from being more attractive than the average person is huge, right? In terms of online dating, it's a big advantage, and that comes as no surprises to anyone because online dating is purely based on your photos and your perceived personality. You don't really get much of a feel of what that person may be like. So photos are very important, facial aesthetics, height, all of these are honest genetic indicators of fitness. They're very desirable because they cannot be changed easily. On the other hand, the advantages of being more educated as a man than the average person, say the average person has a bachelor's and you have a master's or a PhD, it makes very little difference at the end of the day. The benefit for a man is much better in just being more attractive than being smarter or more educated. For women, the benefit is in being slightly less educated, and this is again because of the dynamics I spoke about earlier, where men prefer slightly less educated women than they are themselves, and women, on the other hand, prefer slightly more educated men than they are themselves. On the note of education, I don't mean for it to sound like having a university degree is useless in trying to attract a potential partner, because education ultimately leads to your ability to gather more resources, and money is attractive whether you like it or not. It's attractive for yourself, it's attractive for potential partners, it's financially freeing, and it allows you to live the life that you really want. So for both men and women, it's not a negative to pursue a higher degree, pursue postgraduate study, but you have to understand that for especially women, there's a greater trade-off when you're sacrificing your education levels with your desirability for a potential partner. I don't believe it's because men actively disqualify women with greater degrees or postgraduate study. It's more so women actively seek out men with greater education levels than themselves, which to a point does become very limiting, especially if you're at the top of your field. For men, on the other hand, if you can make the same amount of money as you do with a bachelor's degree versus with a master's degree, getting that master's degree is not going to make you significantly more attractive in any meaningful way. Rather, the ability to get more money, whether that be through your own entrepreneurial endeavors or a promotion at work because of that degree, then that's the thing that's actually making you more attractive, not necessarily having a postgraduate doctoral in front of your name.